This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and it is good to have you with us. A warm welcome to all our regular listeners, and of course to everyone who is tuning in for the first time. We are coming to you from Gothenburg in Sweden, and you can follow us on a regular basis worldwide through our website, redicecreations.com. On our site, you'll find frequently updated news on most of the things that we consider to be important and interesting. Things are moving so fast, it's almost impossible to keep up with everything, but that's why we recommend your tips, your feedback, and alerts as well. On our site, you also find radio interviews, webcasts, films, and other video material. Check out our members area for full access to all of this material. We do interviews with authors, researchers, filmmakers on many different subject matters. Information that we consider to be important, interesting, urgent, and intriguing. And we're not afraid to go into unknown areas and wherever the information leads us. No topic is off limits as we search for answers. The conclusions, though, about the information presented here, we leave up to you. It's the pursuit of truth that counts. We have Twitter feeds along with the YouTube channels, RSS feeds, and so forth on our website. Also sign up for our new free newsletter so you can follow us at your convenience and find out what's new on the website. Okay, so today we have Cliff High with us from halfpasthuman.com. He is behind something called the WebBot, a computer program basically written to predict trends and upcoming future events. And we are going to talk about the WebBot today, how it got started. We're going to discuss future studies and the shape of things to come. So with that, welcome to the program, Cliff. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, no problem at all. Glad to be here.
You know, we've gotten quite a few requests from our listeners to get you on the program to talk about your work over at halfpasthuman.com, the WebBot and so forth. So I think that many will be familiar with you and your work and the story in general. But for those of us who don't know that much about it, maybe you can give us an overview, a quick kind of background on what the WebBot is, what it does, a little bit how it works, and also, I guess, then in terms of how it can help us to predict future events, Cliff.
Sure. The basic concept is that all humans are psychic in some degree, just the way all humans are short or tall in some degree. And the second corollary to that is that the humans are psychic, and whether they know it or not, they're leaking out some of their psychic impression in their particular choice of words in casual everyday conversations, including those conversations that are expressed on the internet. And that we are able, with software that goes out and reads such conversations, to gather in all of these millions of psychic impressions, boil them down to a thick syrupy mass, and skim the top of it for forecasts.
And it's you and George who are basically behind this program, but you're the original author of the code, so to speak. Is that right?
That's correct. I started thinking about language and how we store it in a computer age when I was involved as a consultant to some very large software companies here in the Northwest, who in turn had me be a consultant to some of their clients back in the old Rust Belt part of our country, and that is to say the auto industry and so forth, because we were storing language in huge amounts, but basically it was the same word stored over and over and over again, and I knew there had to be a better way to think about language, its storage and use in a computer age. And one thought led to another, and this was in maybe 1993 or 94. I started thinking about the idea of how language shifts over time, which led to an emotional quantifier for language, which led to the idea that, well, maybe those emotional quantifiers could be captured and used for specific purposes. The original idea was to forecast emerging interest in stocks and so forth, and therefore be able to arrive at a conclusion before the trend actually became manifest within the markets themselves. So basically, it started off as a money-making scheme gone awry.
There you go. And so you got an interesting, I guess, side effect of this then. So how do you go about it? Do you search for specific keywords, or what is the nature of this thing, so to speak?
It's actually about 340 some odd executable programs at this stage, most of them written in Prolog for the data processing itself. There's maybe, I don't know, 50, 80 or something like that programs written in C and Perl that actually go out and do the data gathering. They take as their seed list about 300,000 search terms that we've identified as the descriptor set of of archetypes that we're interested in from our lexicon of 1.7 million words that have been defined with emotional parameters. So they take these 300,000 seed terms and they go hunting. And we really don't care about the seed term per se. We just, because we, all we do really is note where it was found in the time. But then the process is to actually bring back the words that are around it to see what shifts have occurred since the last time we got that seed term in that same spot. And so really what we're looking at is the shift of language over time. And it's kind of interesting because it parallels how language evolves in natural human use in the sense of we're always creating new slang. And the more emotional stress we're under, the more new slang we're going to create. I believe that slang is in essence a side effect, if you will, of the fact that all humans are psychic. And it's not that we're looking at slang per se. I just cite it as an example of how in a macro level language changes over time within our species. It need not. You could, for instance, imagine a species where language was relatively static except for the invention of new words to accommodate new technology, for instance, and that's really the only need for a new word. However, in our species, we think our emotions are not those of our parents, and we need new terms to express our emotions in our context as we come into the world. And so we invent slang and new uses for words, and language morphs over time fairly rapidly. Make sense?
Makes sense. And so how does the program actually filter this out and kind of make coherent sentences for you guys to read, or how do you go about searching in this information that the bots bring out?
It's very much more complex than that. I wish it did spit out the sentences. Then I wouldn't have to write the reports and the interpretation. I could just gather all those, paste them in a document, and there you go.
Yeah.
No, what it does is it brings back words associated in a mind map, if you will, relating to high-level archetypes, primary, secondary, tertiary support for those archetypes, and then down ultimately into detail levels. So you think of it as like a pyramid. So the seed word comes back at the very top of that pyramid, and then associated with that might be 30 or 40,000 words going down to the detail level. And it's up to the humans that look at this model that we've devised that's a visual representation of all of this to decide what a hot spot is and then go and drill down into those 30 and 40,000 words and see if there's anything interesting there. So it's a little bit more complex than you might imagine.
Yeah.
A lot of it is based on the visual impression we get from our 3D IntelliCAD representation. Basically, what I did was to take a free open source CADware IntelliCAD, and then I wrote a Lisp program that uses one pixel per descriptor set and alters intensity, hue, and color based on the level of the shift involved in the language as a result of an emotional sum or a sum of emotional values. And so you actually look at little bright pixels, and it looks like a very chaotic aquarium, if you will.
That's interesting. And how could you, for instance, do you know if you could take this information and put it into another kind of filtering program? For instance, could you create like a tag cloud or something like that, where you actually see kind of keywords, and the bigger they are, the more resonance they carry, so to speak?
Yes, you could, but what prevents us from doing that is just the sheer volume we're dealing with. So we might read 100 million keyword instances in order to create a report. Of those 100 million, we'll probably discard 20 or 30 million for various different reasons, and we're left, say, with 70 million that are active or effective. And just representing that level of complexity pretty much bumps us out of most display formats. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And you mentioned emotional parameters. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that. What do you mean with that?
I decided that way back in the early 90s, it just came to the conclusion that the reason we create slang is, as I said, is an emotional response to the world around us. So as we're growing up and we're teenagers, for instance, it doesn't matter what culture you're in, you find yourself in a situation where your emotions in the context that you're experiencing them in your physical reality is perceived to be different from your parents. And so it is emotion that really drives the creation of new language and the use of language in new and interesting ways. This emotion could be the result of normal teenage angst, or it could be a collective social a pressure because of oppression, or any number of factors. But nonetheless, there's an emotional quantifier to language. Not only does language intend to impart information, but it imparts information for humans in an emotional context. And we use it so often that we sort of become blind or immune to the emotional content of language at that very high level. So what I did was to go through and just created a scale that was initially a negative one to a positive one, with zero being the midpoint, and referenced it in 100th parts of each, and assigned an emotional value to emotions. So in other words, the word fear, I figured, well, that's a negative one. And the word joy was a positive one. And I went through and did this with all of the emotions and the emotionally associated words. So on fear, it was frightened, afraid, etc., all of the various different synonyms. And then I used that emotional value as a sum to determine what's happening relative to language as it changed. But it's a little bit more complex than that, because these emotional values are put into a multidimensional array that's associated with each and every one of the words in our lexicon. This array tells us, for instance, if a word has more of an immediate impact on your life, but not so much a long-lasting one, or vice versa, and various different kinds of parameters.
That's very interesting.
Again, sort of makes sense.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. In a way, I guess you could say that what you guys are doing here is a very, very advanced form of Google Alerts, maybe? Would that be a fairly comparison to make here?
We were sort of, in a sense. We were there, 10 years before, and we're off in a really screwy direction. But that, I think, is a very fair comparison, yes.
And in one way, to me, it sounds like you guys are tapping into, I guess, the human collective unconscious in a way. It's almost like if we look at the World Wide Web as the mind of humanity as a whole, considering what we write about, what we talk about online and so forth, this becomes as a way of almost tapping into that. Would you say that that's correct?
I would say that's exactly correct. That was sort of the intent, that what we really wanted to get at was the bleeding edge of that unconscious to conscious transition. And the only place to really grab it in a text-based world was where the individual words were changing in the same sorts of conversation. So really, for instance, we spend a lot of our time hunting down conversations in bread baking forums, car repair, cooking, any of the ordinary things that you can imagine, because it's really there that all of the hidden archetypes emerge, such places as conspiracy fora, political, religious. Any of these areas are less fruitful for us, because it's up in a conscious realm, and we're not really so much interested in that, because that has a tendency to alter the psychic filter.
Would you say that from your point of view, the more people that are online on forums and write blogs, etc., the better it is and the more accurate it will become?
I believe that to be the case, and I'm rather concerned about the intention of places like Australia to filter and replace language with automated software, sort of this online instant censorship kind of thing. And then there's been real problems for us as China grew to the point where their internet was dominated by the central authority. We found ourselves blocked from a huge level of resources of actually very prescient and psychically oriented people that was very nice to mine, and now it's been blocked to us. So there are issues in the future.
Has anyone from, let's say, military or other kind of information gathering, unit or government agencies or so forth, shown any kind of interest in your software?
That's kind of that's a question I hesitate to answer directly, because there's sort of a yes and a no component to it. Yes, we have a number of military people that are subscribers and they read it. I'm sure a number of the more shadow government kind of people are also subscribers and read it, as well as those that are, you know, outspokenly at .mil addresses. But in an official sense, no, we've never had any of the, you know, big SUVs drive up and a cadre of officials come on out and say, hey, let's talk.
And you mentioned a little bit here about, you know, the way you search sites and so forth as well. Maybe we can talk a little bit about what kind of sites you monitor. Have you gone and plugged domain names into the search spider or the search engine yourselves, or do you scan the entire web with aid of other search engines, or how does this work?
It's actually the latter. We have our own built-in inherent search engine that's what's known as a following or trailing spider. And that is to say that our spiders are given an initial key address. They may be given, a list of 20 or 30,000 forum to start with. And they would start with one of them. And it's very complex because the spider has the ability, the heuristics involved, allow it to go down 256 layers in links from a keyword outward before having to trace its way back and begin at the next level. So this data gathering process is 24/7 for weeks continuously just to get us to a point of about 40 or 50 million reads that we can start our interpretation. And it does get very complex. Some of the spiders don't return until the very end of the process, whereas others find very few interesting links and therefore don't go into these long spirals, because each and every link up to a certain point allows them to go an additional 256 layers and so on. So you can see that it can get rather mushroomy, so to speak.
Yeah.
However, we now are taking advantage of some of the other of the interfaces that are allowed at the search engines, and we have a keyword search that is uses regular expressions of some complexity that are in fact created by a Prolog program, and that then use the search engine core storage and sort of root around in that as a starting point. So we're sort of covering it from both sides. The real key, by the way, is to find sites, and the ultimate thing is to recognize new words when they form, because frequently the words that are brought back are meaningless to us. But if you can catch the new ones as they're forming usually in music or extreme sports or some of these other areas, boy, then you're really onto that, because you can follow that emotion as it matures.
Hmm. That's interesting. And do you follow mainstream news media and also alternative news media, or how do you go about that?
Yeah, those are read routinely, both as a couple of starting points within our list. But frequently, we also, of course, the spiders also get links to those. So it might go hunting on a keyword related to, say, sunflower seeds. And then that kicks it. It finds an interesting link that leads it over to a conspiracy forum, which then in turn leads it back to an article on the mainstream media. That kind of a deal.
So it's a cross domain name, so to speak, and it search certain kind of, what do you call it, subdomains or below
correct.
Levels?
Oh,
okay.
Correct.
Really interesting. And so how many years have you guys been doing this now, then?
My first real run was done in 1997, and I've been doing it pretty much continuously since then. So 11 or 12 years now.
And what is the image that is starting to building here in terms of accuracy, I guess, but also in terms of where things are going?
In terms of accuracy, I always say that we're twice what chance would allow, but that of course means we're still wrong half the time. And that's rather a misleading statement, and I don't do that deliberately to mislead, but for those people whose monkey minds want to deal with numbers, it gives them a fair approximation of where we're at. We're about 51 or 52% right in the main, if you wanted to look at it as a sheer number of words that are actually matched up. However, our accuracy is a little bit more complex than that, because at an archetype level, it's extremely accurate. But as we drill down towards the details, only occasionally are we extremely accurate at the detail level, but when we are, it can be spectacularly accurate in the sense that we had the number 300,000 dead show up 8 months before the tsunami. And by all accounts, it was around that number that were killed. We had the Northeast power outage here in the U.S., which was a big deal. It was not determined to be terrorism or anything, but we had a huge amount of the words around that 3 weeks out, and we were about 92% or more of the linguistics that we forecast actually showed up in the mainstream media that day and the following day about the event. And that's actually how we judge our success, by the way. Because what we seem to get is not a description of an event in the future, but rather a leaking out of humans as to what those words will be used to describe that event shortly after it's happened. Kind of a confusing description, and I'm not trying to weasel out of accuracy ratings or anything here, but I want to make it clear that in the case of the Northeast power outage, one of the first words we had was terrorism. And it was determined not to be a terrorist event, but that didn't matter because on everybody's lips, the instance that the power was lost all through the northeast part of the United States, instantly everybody thought it was a terrorist act. So that also showed up in the media. So we got that word accurately, even though in fact the event had nothing to do with terrorism. Again, that sort of makes sense?
Absolutely, and that's very interesting. So how does it deal with things in regards to what actually happened, so to speak? Because again, there are going to be certain events which are more difficult to track down the origins of, or what actually happened, who was behind it, and so forth. Are there any clues here hidden in regards to who or what might be behind an event?
We have some of that, but it's not an area I've ever pursued. More due to lack of time and the pressures of other chores than any other reason. So it's not like I was particularly afraid to go and look at that, but it was never particularly a personally profitable or a pleasing kind of a road to go down, if you understand what I'm saying. And there's so many events that are pressing on us, and gathering the data, you have to understand that our data is actually sliced at the broad level into two categories. What we determine, or what we call emotionally building or tension building language, and emotionally releasing language. But within those categories, across sliced a different way, all of the data falls into groups that we call immediacy, short term, or longer term values. And the immediacy values are where we get all of the really interesting detail that provide us a really substantial number of our hits. The problem is that the immediacy data is effective from about 3 days from when we find it out to about 3 weeks. So just the interpretation, just the gathering and then the interpretation process means that frequently we'll see stuff in the immediacy data, but it's already occurred. And of course, there's no point in forecasting something that's already happened.
That's right.
So what we do then is call it racing time. And it becomes rather stress-filled and pressure-filled to try and plow through all the immediacy data in a timely manner and get a report out. But it has yielded some just spectacular things, such as the immediacy data was responsible for our forecast 3 days before the Olympics in Greece a few years back, that the Greek Olympic team would suffer some accidents. Sure enough, they had a motorcycle accident of two of their best athletes just hours before the opening of the game the next day, that kind of a deal. So it's very accurate and can provide some just staggering insights. Now, the reason I think it's very accurate is an aside that is interesting as well, because it goes back to the idea that everybody is psychic, and to a certain extent, most people don't know it, even if they wouldn't even allow that they're psychic. Even if they deny it, they are. But the issue is that the more they are unaware of their psychic ability, probably, in my mind, their ability to reach further out into time is reduced. So I think most of our immediacy data comes from these people that really are unaware of their own psychic ability. They're going about their daily lives, and they're just leaking this information out on the internet, not knowing about it, but it doesn't look out very far into the future. Make sense?
Yeah, and would you also say then that the bigger of an event, meaning the more emotional impact or resonance, if I can use that word, so an event will have, and tension building consequently, do you think that it will be easier to predict such an event even though it's further into the future?
That is just the way it worked out, as a matter of fact. And you've hit on what we call the George Uhr postulate. Now, George Uhr ran an economics site that I read because he's a very good writer. And I just used to read it rather haphazardly up until about 1999, when everybody started really getting focused on economics. Now, at that point, I'd already abandoned the idea of using my software approach to forecast the market because I was too intrigued about all of these other psychic impressions that were coming through and was trying to sort out in my mind what I was really getting back in the way of the data. But at some point in the year 2001, I think it was perhaps June or so, I contacted George Ure and I told him, look, I've got all this data that suggests we're going to hit this tipping point. And the tipping point is going to mean that everybody on the planet is going to live their lives differently after the tipping point. And I've got some data here that sort of half-assed describes it. And I think that this thing will hit in the next 90 days. And I also told him at that time that I think the most probable point is that it'll hit within the first 15 of those 90 days and that the potential for it to hit will trail off in those 90 days. This is a key part for me because what I was getting to is this idea of sort of a feedback loop. It turns out that I was forecasting the tipping point that occurred emotionally with the attacks on 9/11. Yeah. But because of the way I had my mathematics, I thought it would happen in earlier part of summer. If I had reversed my math, I would have seen that the weighted potential would have been in the last 15 days of that 90 days, which would have gotten me in the framework of the 1st of September to the 15th, and I would have been bang on, so to speak, no pun intended, on that particular day. Now, we've used that feedback approach to develop, as the words appear, we're able to refine the emotions and put them back into the lexicon, and we call it tuning the lexicon, and it gets rather intense. But getting back to the George Ure postulate, George was brought into the project at that point because we posted this on his site, and he's maintained it at his site at urbansurvival.com ever since our original posting in June or July of that year. And he has maintained a historical record of our forecast because my goal was always to be intellectually honest about this. I didn't know where it would lead, but there was no point in trying to fudge the numbers or make it something that it wasn't. And I really wanted it. It was very tedious to do, and I kind of really wanted it to crap out on me if it was going to. So what I do, though, is the Ure postulate, getting back to that. George noticed over the course of 2001 and 2002, as we were discussing all of the data coming on in, because he was quite fascinated, that there was a tendency for these longer-range things to show up months in advance as, if you will, sort of a little trickle, and then gradually build over time until we could get a better focus on them. So, indeed, you're quite correct. The longer term, or the larger the emotional impact, the further out ahead of it we will see that event.
In terms of 9/11, then, could you, or did you guys find out what actually was going to happen? Or was it more that this will be a big emotional resonance here, but we don't know exactly where or what will happen? Or can you find out more details at that point when you see something coming, so to speak, on the horizon? Can you target in on that more specifically and find out more details about it?
Yes, we can. And we have our original post at George's urban survival site, which was basically like one or two paragraphs about what I called Screwy Theory 153. And it describes what we saw sort of coming. But here's our issue. At that point in 2001, I had had my lexicon. It had 300,000 words, but I was only up to the M's in terms of getting an emotional quantifier attached to the major words. So I hadn't reached the point where I could have quantified the T words and picked up terrorism. So our description shows it as being an accident plus military. Somehow we knew it was going to be a, quote, military accident. And that's what came through in the data sets. And I'm convinced it was because we didn't have the word terrorism modeled. If we'd had terrorism modeled, that would have risen to a higher level of archetype, and then the accident and military would have made sense under the idea of a terrorist act. So basically what it was a limited structure on the lexicon, because bear in mind I started off looking for words that were essentially associated with the economic system, you know, and bonds and stocks and all that kind of stuff. So I had a lot of those words modeled, but I didn't have a lot of the more general words modeled. And in fact, it took us until 2003, I think, to go through that initial 300,000 words.
There you go. And what would happen, so to speak, if a government, for instance, is trying to put out propaganda about something? They're trying to put out information or even misinformation about something in order to create a consensus, so to speak. Is this also something that would be reflected, and can you discover if it is indeed true or false information?
Well, we can see if it's true or false information, but we don't really ever go there. We do indeed see the what we call memering, where the government is engineering a meme or thought virus, or let's say government. The powers that be is an easier and better description.
Right, right.
Even though indeed their arm and getting it out might be the government, more often than not, it's their propagandic mainstream press. But the point is well taken, and that is that the government can indeed engineer thought viruses that they wish to have sweep through the population at large, and they do it all the time. From our viewpoint, the factual value of the position that they're taking is neither here nor there. It is this forceful, if you will. Let me put it this way. When a memering episode occurs, the number of words being used is limited, and it has a shock value through the data that is easily seen within our both visual representation and within the emotional sums, because of the limited number of words. So it's like they take a limited number of talking point words and their propaganda arm just use them over and over and over and over and over again, and we get this emotional spike, if you will, that's very easy to pick out.
Very interesting. And considering the background in regards to watching the money market and so forth, could you guys see anything in regards to the financial crash or whatever we want to call it that actually began about over a year ago now?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We were actually ahead of things on the very first time I used that to any effect was actually in the year 2000. As a former Microsoft Consulting Services subcontractor, I had put some of the money I had made from them and purchased a few Microsoft stock, like 40 shares or something. Anyway, I saw used the software and it said, basically it said, bad things are coming. So I sold all of the Microsoft stock. And 2 weeks later, the whole thing fell apart in the year 2000. So it has indeed worked very well that way. And in a general sense, we were about a year ahead. We started seeing our death of the dollar words in 2002. So that'll give you an idea of how much of an impact that's going to have in the coming year or so. The fact that we had seen it out 7 years in advance of its real first appearance in 2008-2009, according to your postulate, means it's going to have a tremendous impact. So for instance, the tsunami, we first got a hint of that 8 months out. So 300,000 people perish, and we had a land pushed back to a previous age, and we get an 8-month warning. So a 7-year warning is going to really be a globe-altering event. In any event, though, the stock market stuff we'd actually were able to peg the day of the most risk to the system, and that later on it came out the central bank and warfare model for the western part of the planet was within 3 hours of a meltdown on October 7th. And it was at that we'd been saying for a year that October 7th would be the particular day of risk, even though the stock market or whatever, the financial system started to appear to come unraveled on the 15th of September of 2008. The point of maximum stress was October 7th, and then we had a 5-month level of release language, as was forecast. And so, again, we're at that same position where our data now is indicating that in the future we have the next phase of this ongoing soap opera of the dollar death, and it will arrive very shortly.
Well, I definitely want to get in here a little bit later here, more about not only in terms of the financial situation, but also other events here in the future and so forth. But a few more things I want to ask you before that. How about correlating experiments? How would you say that this is different, or rather, can you use information from, for example, the NewSphere Princeton University project? They have these little eggs that apparently also in one way or another help to, quote-unquote, predict 9/11, or at least they picked up something on the event before that. They don't know what it was going to be, but just that it was going to be big and have an impact. Can you look at their data as well and correlate with what you guys do?
Probably, but that would be a whole lot of work, and I'm lazy. So, and we couldn't do it in real time in a running fashion and make any sense of it. I understand why theirs did as it does, and that is because we live in an energetic universe, and they were picking up the first wave of that energy. Ours seems to pick it up much longer term in advance. And I believe that's because the human body is a much greater antenna, if you will. The human mind or consciousness is a greater antenna than is the random number generators used in the noosphere.
Oh, that is interesting. That's something we definitely can go into more later on here. But one thing I was thinking about as well is how do you present this information then? Do you have reports that you write for halfpasthuman.com, or how do you go about presenting some of this data that you guys find?
Yeah, that's correct. At the moment, we are producing reports under the title The Shape of Things to Come. They're available off of halfpasthuman.com. They're $10 U.S. to purchase a report. They're presented in more or less a newsletter fashion. They're mostly very dense text because it's an interleaving of the actual words that we find within the extracts, within the data processing, and we attempt to put those words into a context that more or less reads like a narrative, but it's a very dense narrative, almost as though one is navigating some kind of an subconscious. So to a certain extent, it probably reads a lot like Ulysses, as I remember James Joyce's Ulysses reading, only in a grander scale, not so much personally focused. So people need to be aware of that. It's also very grim. This is because of the way in which I started defining the emotions at the beginning of the project. It was, of course, very easy or easier to assign an emotional value to a more extreme emotion than to a subtle one. And so, therefore, we have a tendency to have our data natively or naturally as an artifact of our processing bring back more extreme emotions, which has a tendency to color our reports in a more extreme fashion. And we find that really rarely does the future present itself in quite that level of extreme, although many of the extreme words we use will indeed show up in the press after the event. Knowing them in advance has a tendency to color your thinking, and so again, you need to be aware of that. In other words, this is as bad as it will get is sort of a subtitle to the reports.
There we go. And how often do you guys put out reports approximately?
It's working out now at about once every quarter, so once every 3 months or so because of the amount of work. And the reports run about 50 pages of actual interpretation and maybe one or two charts involved. But as I say, it takes us between 18 days and 3 or 4 weeks of pre-processing to gather the data. So rather lengthy time involved. But we're trying to – it's not ever going to be able to go to monthly. The best we could probably do would be something every other month. And I don't know that we'll get to that point. Once every 3 months seems to be about right. We can project out 3 months with some confidence. And beyond that, with even greater confidence, actually out to about 6 or 8 months. So it gets a nice view. And I find that the data changes over time. It's unfortunately for us, I think Terence McKenna is right, and there's some form of time compression, if you will, as we approach this 2012 business. And as a result of that, there appears to be more events, more data for us to process. So, in fact, it may turn out that we're going to have to lengthen the cycle just because of the amount of data.
There you go. So, so what you've been able to assess in a way so far then is that this the time compression that you mentioned here, that is actually something that is taking place. I mean, I just mentioned it here in the beginning as well, so to speak, that it's almost impossible to keep an eye on everything that's going on. But this is correlated as well in terms of what you guys are finding then?
Oh, it's empirically measurable, correct. I mean, ever since the first 200 executable programs that I wrote are still in use today. The additional 130 or so I put in for display purposes or tuning or whatever. But nonetheless, so the software is basically run against an internet that has grown over time, but even factoring that out, we're still seeing within those same 200 programs an increased workload, even though much of the internet is actually reduced to us in the sense that we can't reach certain points of Australia, China, etc. So, yeah, I'm quite convinced that we're being presented with empirical evidence of this time compression.
And are there specific kind of, I guess, big trends that you follow, or do you let the information that comes out speak for itself, and that is the trend, so to speak, for that time period that you are going to follow up on?
The latter. We run in what's known as serendipitous mode. we can run deterministically. So I can take the software and provide it with seed words and only look at certain elements that come back from those seed words. Or I can run in the serendipitous mode, which is the way I usually like to do it, just because of the surprise, actually. But to let it go out, find the seed words, then go out and read up to 2048 words on either side of the seed word, find and extract lexical lengths from that, and then use those to go off and hunt and bring back another set of words to begin the immediacy data grabs. So it's actually removed from my control as to what the words will be. And it's just up to universe as to where the spiders first encounter them and so on.
And so in your view here, to kind of summarize, I guess, what we talked about so far, in your view, is this a way to actually predict the future accurately?
I think it's a way to predict the language that will show up in the future, even if that language is wrong. So we have to be very clear about this, and because we're using language to discuss language. But here's really the situation. I feel I can accurately predict what language will be showing up after a particular event in the future. But if that language is distorted or wrong, that's the vision of it that I pick up. So in other words, let's imagine a situation in which the attacks on the Twin Towers in 9/11 were caused by nefarious elements within the shadow government of the U.S., and other international players for the powers that be, and not the greater Muslim Brotherhood or whatever led by Osama. So because everybody in the U.S. is under the impression after the event that this is an attack by Muslim extremists and radical clerics, that's the language I pick up. Whether or not that is true is not something that really shows up within our data. So we're accurate because that language shows up, but we might not be factual. Does that make sense?
I see what you mean. It's like you know again what's going to happen, but that is based upon the language that it has been described in. Meaning that if you pick up the trends from official news sources, that is the reply, so to speak, that you are going to get back. Right?
Correct. It's as though we're looking through people's eyes in the future is they read newspapers or whatever about an event. And so whatever it is they're reading is what we pick up, not the reality of that event. Which is a little spooky. I never actually figured that this would ever occur this way at all. And it took us some time to determine that that was the case.
Yeah. So if we go into Hill here a bit briefly about some of the topics that I definitely want to continue an hour or two with you and go into much more in regards to the future. But if we begin with that already here, we mentioned, or you mentioned rather, a little bit in regards to the financial situation and so forth. Generally, is there something that you can mention to us about this? Where are we heading, and where do you see the outcome of all of this will become, and how long into the future here are you able to see? Do you see that as a big impact, meaning that it will be a big emotional impact because of the events in the future in terms of the financial situation?
Yes, it's going to be huge, planetary, in fact, in terms of the financial system's impact on everybody. And as to how far into the future we can apparently look, we have our long-term data's level of maximum granularity decreases after about 19 months. So really, we like to make our interpretations based on the trends that we can see within a 19-month or less period of time. And right at the moment, we're looking at a very rough period of time for the whole central bank and warfare model that runs the planet. And that hard period of time from our data starts about November 4th of this year and extends all the way through November 2nd of next year.
I read something as well about a potential something upcoming in October. Don't know if it was speculation or not, or something that you guys put out, but can you mention something about that?
Sure. On October 25th, well, let me just say that on August 22nd of this year, our data indicated and had been forecast for that week, and it actually turned out to be on the 22nd. But we went into a period, I say we, the planet, went into a period of what we call release language, where the language is more about releasing emotion than about building tension emotion. And the way I like to characterize it is that building tension is when you come across an accident or something horrific and all the muscles in your body tense up and you have that indrawn breath and your stomach muscles tense. And that's a building tension emotion. The release is just the opposite of that. It's where you're angry and you just start yelling. So you're releasing the emotion. So we're in a release period of time that started on August 22nd and will continue until the 25th of October. And it'll take a very, very sharp turn at that point and go into building tension that will last about 10 to 10 and a half days. And we think that the majority of that may indeed be involved with the financial system, but we cannot rule out that there's a potential international chaos around the warfare component either.
In regards to when you look at the data, do you also personally follow the news around the story to confirm or not? And if so, is it difficult to keep your own opinion, so to speak, out of it?
Yes, on both of those. Yes, I look at real world potential in order to figure out a probability, because what we're doing is forecasting trends, not simply speculating off of emotional linguistics. And yes, indeed, it's very difficult to keep my own opinion out of it. And therefore, there's a whole lot of subjects I just prefer not to go into, because I know that my personal opinion would cloud my ability to make any kind of a rational interpretation from the data.
Hmm. And again, in terms of this period that we are entering, a release, does that mean that the tension then that has been building during this time is going to be released? Does that necessarily mean bad times ahead, or could it actually mean good times ahead?
It could mean good. In our experience, that has not been the case in the recent years. But release tension is neither good or bad. It's just the release of emotion. So, for instance, imagine a situation where we're in release tension now. Everybody's basically releasing their tension in the mainstream media about all of the financial system in a gradual sort of a sense. It doesn't appear too chaotic right at the moment. But say that it accelerated and we got to a point where in October, on October 25th, we had a Cuban Missile Crisis kind of an event. That is to say, what if we had a showdown over the period of from the 25th until of the October to the 4th of November between a nuclear-armed and ready-to-attack Israel going against Iran, and maybe for some reason Russia or China decided to join them, and so Israel hesitated, and we had 10 days of tension. Well, if the tension broke and everybody stepped back and there was no war, then yes, we could have all that release in language be in a sense about a big, oh boy, we sure missed having a problem there, we're all relieved about it, and so on. On the other hand, that release language could just as easily go towards the horror everybody expresses as the war actually occurs. And we cannot tell the difference from our viewpoint now.
And speaking of Iran, that this is something that is being ramped up now again in the media. Allegedly, they found another site where they are extracting for, Western sources say that it's for potential nuclear weapons and so forth. The Iranians themselves say that this is only for purposes of nuclear power plants and so forth. Do you see Iran on the horizon here as well? This has been, you know, ongoing now since, I don't know, 2004 almost, back and forth all the time with Iran here. But do you see that will play out in any way?
We have a theme within our data, a trend line, that we've had since, I want to say, probably 2002, maybe even early 2001, that we've called the Israeli mistake. And it appears as though that if the Israelis actually go against Iran, and that appears to be within the cards, I mean, within the data stream right now, I would have to say the probability is, as these things go, pretty certain between now and the end of the year, that Israel will make a decision, or will be faced with making a decision on a particular day to attack or not. Beyond that, I can't say because of the nature of language that we've discussed. However, that broad theme that we've had of the Israeli mistake is a particularly grim one, because it includes an attack on Iran using a bunker buster kind of a technology, hitting an inappropriate target that may indeed cause some weird thing like nuclear radiation leaking into oil fields And then the oil fields erupt into giant flaming geysers that spew the nuclear radiation all over the planet for about 18 weeks.
Hmm. Well, that is very, very interesting. Cliff, why don't we do like this then? We'll round things up here for the first hour and then continue after the break talking more. But before we do that, please let us know how we can find out more information about the WebBot, what you guys are doing, you and George, and how, again, we can get access to the reports that you are producing.
You can go to halfpasthuman.com to purchase the reports. There's just a little link there, allows you to use PayPal or send us a check, and we'll send it to you electronically. If you want to read about the history of what we've done and see some of the past reports that have been posted on George's site, you can go to urbansurvival.com, go to his main page and scroll down about two-thirds of the way, and he has a number of links, including a simple explanation of how they work, how the technology works, as well as the previous postings that we've kept on his site as kind of a historical record.
There you go. So basically urbansurvivor.com and halfpasthuman.com. Thank you very much for this first hour, Cliff. Stay with us and we'll be right back. Okay, that's our first hour with Cliff High, and you're in for a heck of a ride in the next hour for Red Eye's members, as we'll continue to talk about the future, the predictions and interpretations of the material that the web bot produce. We also talk about Cliff's interpretation of much of the information. The short version is that things are going to get really, really, really weird on this planet, at least in terms of how things are right now. What is the nature of the changes? What can we expect? We talk about the overthrow of the New World Order system, a second American Revolution. We talk about time compression leading up to 2012, and that our galaxy is entering into a region where we could fully merge into the Milky Way, considering that we're way out on one of the spiraling arms right now. We could also end up on the outside, and we break this down in the second hour. We also talk about the effects, obviously, that this change will have upon us, the planet, our sun, and consequent Earth changes. We talk about contact in and around 2011. This is alien contact, and even the potential fighting going on between humans and aliens. This is what the WebBot predicts. We discuss the feedback loop of the information, changes in human awareness, and what Cliff calls the big squeeze, and that certain factions within the governments and the elites might be attempting to go underground, and actually that this won't save them from the karmic cycle. We talk about fertility and fertility technologies and the consequence of going underground. We also go into the grace a little bit and discuss the intent of these creatures and the stories about them from the ancient records. But we'll begin to talk about human psychic ability, the nature of the universe, and how all of this actually isn't that far-fetched in the grand scheme of things. So log into our members area and tune in to Hour 2. If you're not already a member, information can be found, obviously, on our website, redicecreations.com. Just click on subscribe, sign up, and get instant access. It's fast, quick, and very easy. You'll get full access to our archives with radio, films, webcasts, video interviews, and all the other material that we have up there for you. Upcoming on the program, we have Andrew D. Bashago, Eldon Taylor, and Richard Dolan. We appreciate you listening and your support. We'll be back after some music with Hour 2 of our program with Cliff High.